All right, everybody, welcome back to another episode of Autastic.
Your voice sounded really manly there. I like that. That was a very
pretty cool, right?
That was a very Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Autastic is the comedian's guide to autism.
Not science, usually.
No, not usually. But today, heavy on the science.
Today's science day.
Yeah, mega heavy. We are not scientists, so we interviewed someone who is also not a scientist, but knows a heck of a lot about this specific field of research into autism. She has her own fund, the Jill Escher Fund, where she funds autistic research.
Research into genetics, yeah.
Genetics. She talks to brainiacs all day. She is a former lawyer herself. So she knows how to get after that research, you know what I mean? And use big words and stuff. So
she's going to have to dumb it down for me.
For our country yokel,
yeah,
if Kirk
she wants
Smith.
If she wants to get in my brain, she's going to have to slow it down.
But very, very excited to have Jill on. But first, before we get to that very exciting, important interview, we are going to do a week in review, and boy, oh boy, we got a good one for you. Our buddy Kirk, I'm Graham K, by the way, if you're new to this episode.
Oh, yeah,
new
I'm
to
Kirk
this
Smith.
That's Kirk Smith.
Comedian's Guide to Autism, podcast.
We're two comedians, and Kirk just got back from a two-week run in Australia doing shows down there. How was that? Was that fun?
That was weird, yeah. It was
specific to autism, how?
I was at the Perth Comedy Festival, the Fringe Festival in Australia.
Yes.
And I put together my own one-man show, A Comedian's Guide to Autism, Rice Krispies with Ketchup.
Awesome.
And yeah, we had a good run. We teamed up with a bunch of autism organizations in Australia, the Autism Association of Western Australia, the Autism West,
yep,
and then half a dozen other organizations, and we had a really great turnout. It was a really great experience. And I think the thing that's funny to me is the more I travel, the older I get, is there's so much more that unites us than divides us as people, you know, all over the world, where you hang out with people and you realize
that's why it's important to travel. I think
so too.
So you had a good run, sold out shows.
Yeah, I did seven shows. I did about 15 shows, but I did about seven that were exclusively an hour about an autism show, basically. And yeah, we had some sold out shows. We were right downtown, and
Perth.
Moved a lot of books. It was great.
Perth,
that's right.
Yeah. West Coast, right?
Yeah, crazy beaches, crazy white sand beaches, and shark sightings, and it was great.
Peter would have loved it. Sharks and hoo-hoos. My brother calls hoo-hoos boobs, or boobs hoo-hoos.
We'd have to get him those glasses like your dad does, so yeah, he can't see where exactly he's looking. What else can I tell you about it? It was fun. It was hung out with a little bit of Arch Barker, a friend of ours, a comedian friend of ours. We were talking about how famous he is in Australia.
I've met him a couple times. I wouldn't call him a friend, but no, for not any particular nefarious reason other than I've only met him once or twice, but he seemed like a really cool guy.
Yeah, he's a buddy of mine.
He's a huge celebrity down there.
Yeah, it's funny how...
Like, he's a real... It's like he's like Tom Cruise.
You know how, like, oh, I'm huge in Finland, that whole, like, yeah, joke where comedians say, like, I'm huge in Finland, but he is huge in Australia.
Yeah.
He's bigger than...
Like, he has to wear a hat and sunglasses.
Yeah, and still people stopped us in the street.
That's amazing.
It was amazing.
And he's big enough here.
Like he's big here, but he's bigger there, unbelievably. Yeah,
it's just weird how that happens.
I don't know how that works, yeah. But the weekend review, no, it was great. We had and we got a lot of really nice notes. I got a lot of really nice notes from a lot of moms and dads, and we had people drive 3 or 4 hours.
That wow.
Had, yeah, it was really
and how they else. How they hear about it.
Through the different autism organizations, I partnered with them, and mm-hmm. I got, you know, included some newsletters, and so yeah, we had really, it was really quite amazing.
That's
it was really
great.
Humbling, really, to be honest.
That's great, man! Congratulations.
People take the time to come, and
that makes me happy.
Yeah.
And I saw your book was being sold, Rice Krispies with Ketchup, also available on Amazon, also available for audiobook as well. It was being sold at some local bookstores out there.
Yeah, so. we sold a few hundred books, and then people forgot to, you know, after the show, didn't get it. So then it's now in some local bookstores. Calypso, I'm saying it wrong, but I'll look it up. It's all posted in the things. It was exciting stuff.
If you're listening in Perth,
If you're listening,
go to this bookstore that he can't remember.
But I can't remember the name of. Unbelievable.
And also, yeah, if anywhere in Australia, it's a small country. So if you're in Sydney, drive to Perth.
Just like what is that?
Don't go to Amazon.
12-hour drive?
Don't go to Amazon. Drive 15 hours across a desert.
Across the desert.
Yeah.
Of the,
there's only one way.
Okay, you're going to have to help me with the spelling. I looked it up. You helped me with the word here. I don't know how to pronounce this, Graham. I never can pronounce these words. Kaleido?
Yeah, Kaleido.
Kaleido.
Kaleido Books and Gifts. Kaleido.
It's so right down at the train station, right downtown Perth.
Right. And, it's worthwhile mentioning on this podcast because now you are the new Arj Barker of autism comedy. You're huge in Australia for
the autism
comedy community. It's an even a subgenre of the autism community. So, man. Buckle up.
Oh, that's funny. That's funny. So that was it. That was my that's my weekend review. 2 weeks in Australia doing shows, and it was
that's
good to
rad.
Be back.
Good
Hard
for you,
to be
man.
Back, but good to be back.
Good for you.
How was your week?
I've been hanging out with my parents. They are in California, being retired people, and staying. My girlfriend and I stayed at their condo, and we were talking about we were having some wine after dinner, a few wines. And they were talking about how they thought that there was something wrong with, not neurotypical, when I was two or three, because I exhibited a lot of the similar traits that my brother ended up having, my younger brother, 3 years later. Mm-hmm. They obviously didn't know what my brother was going to be like, but they noticed that something, like I didn't know this, but I would open and close the screen door for like hours.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I don't know. I guess I just muscled through autism. Maybe when I was three or four. I was like, no. Now I just have crippling ADHD, and I can't remember faces and or names. So
my name's Kirk.
Hello.
We do a podcast
Nice
together.
To meet you.
You're here every week. We have peanuts and coffee.
I cannot remember faces. It's really weird. But anyway, that's my week in review. And also... yeah, I have through our interview with Jill. I'll let you in a little secret. We've already done the interview. We're recording this after.
Come on, you're showing behind the curtain.
Oh, really? Should edit this out. She said she had this little nugget that she dropped, where she said that people who have autistic children, their other kids don't necessarily aren't autistic, but they will more typically have other things as well, such as ADHD. And I was like, ding, just like your phone, just like your phone that you don't turn off for our podcast.
In my defense, yeah. I had to have it on because anyway, it doesn't matter.
Anyway, good timing on the ding. that was my week in review. Guys, we love you very much.
Hold on a second. We're gonna introduce our topic du jour. The topic du jour this week before the interview is genetics.
Genetics.
That's our topic du jour.
The topic du jour is genetics.
And why don't you introduce it? Without further ado, this is our interview with the very intelligent Jill Escher.
Hope you like it. All right, everybody. This is the interview we were talking about. We are very, very excited to have our next guest. Kirk, do you want to do the intros?
Sure. I was approached about putting together a benefit in Northern California, and the lady who has helped me put together the benefit reached out to Jill Escher, who is the... Jill, why don't you tell us a little about yourself? We were lucky enough to get together in person, but I'd love for you to...
I love this story. Jill is... funds autism research and knows a lot about the science, how we always say we're not scientists. And she was listening to our podcast and couldn't bear these two buffoons talking about it.
I couldn't take it anymore.
And she actually reached out to us and was like,
I think, Jill, I offered you to be on the podcast. You politely declined. And then you heard us talk about science for a few more weeks. And you're like, you know what? Let me rethink this.
Yeah, so we're excited to have you. We appreciate it. Why don't you give our listeners a little rundown of what exactly
sure.
you do?
So thanks for having me, and I really enjoy your podcast. I'm first and foremost the mother of two children with nonverbal forms of autism. Mm-hmm. One is 17, a big boy, just like same age as Kirk's boy.
Sounds yeah. vaguely
big
familiar.
Boy, big muscle, all muscles, all muscles and facial hair now, and such a sweetie, such a cutie. His name is Johnny, and then I have a 9-year-old nonverbal daughter named Sophie, mm-hmm. A real beauty and love, but, you know, significantly challenged as right. As your mm-hmm. listener. I don't have to, you know, preach to your choir.
No.
And, yeah, so I wear a lot of hats, but I met Kirk because I got a call from somebody who wanted to get in touch with Autism Society San Francisco Bay Area, and I'm president of that organization. We do a lot of advocacy and a lot of events, and you can check out our website, sfautismsociety.org. Mm-hmm. But I spend most of my time in the realm of autism research, which is why I listen to you guys and weep, because, you know, I'm like, you know, you guys are talking, I'm like, wait, but, can I? And so I'm kind of butting in right now in real life.
Oh, this is great. We're really excited to have you.
Yeah, but, you know, it's kind of the unfunny stuff. You guys are like the comedian's guide to autism. This is like the unfunny episode. You know, autism no. research is just not funny.
we'll add goofy sound effects after we record
we'll,
this.
We'll punch
in the
us
background.
Up later yeah. on. We'll yeah. add the jokes later.
A lot of boings and stuff like that.
Yeah, but, like, you know, in the last episode, and I'm not sure where this one where we're recording now will mm-hmm. fall, but the last one I heard, at least, you guys were talking about, well, what causes autism? You know, you were talking about the heritability of autism, for mm-hmm. example. And you guys were going back and forth, well, you know, if you have one kid with autism, then you're more likely to have another kid with autism. And we see that, you know, in the epidemiology mm-hmm. And, you know, what could be causing that? And it's genetic, but, you know, it's, you know, we have more and more autism. How can we have something that's genetic also be increasing in number? And, you know, it is. It's this big, confusing mm-hmm. world out there. And so, yeah, I'll butt in a little bit. And do you want to have a little tiny science lecture?
I would love yeah, nothing more. And this is specific to what you help fund and research. So
yeah, and I fund really kind of cutting edge, mm-hmm. kind of new emerging concepts in autism.
And so, if I read it right, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, these hereditary potential causes are ideas that you came up with doing your own research about your mother's pregnancy.
That's right. And I specialize in, you know, what's called gene-environment interaction. Like, what mm-hmm. are the, what's out there, right? What are the, you know, the chemicals or the exposures or the stresses, you know, that could be having impacts on our genes and then giving rise to what are really genomic phenomenon mm-hmm. in our children. You know, it used to be when I started funding autism research more than a decade ago. And, you know, back then, you know, the strong theme in autism research was it's either genes or it's the environment.
Right.
Right. One or the other. Those were seen as two separate.
Nurture
kind of
or nature. It's like the old question. Yeah.
Yeah, genes or environment, right? Like, you know, so it's in like your DNA.
It hasn't changed a lot. People still think that.
But it's changing very rapidly. Right. And so what happened was a lot of the money went into like gene hunting, right? And we've successfully found, you know, about 10% of autism cases are, you know, related to very identifiable and confirmed, you know, genetic aberrations, you know, mutations.
Right.
Another 10%. Are probably related to other genetic abnormalities that they're finding, although those have yet to be really confirmed. So we do know, obviously, you know, there is a genetic basis, but right now, at most, we know about 20% of the cases are related to those genes.
Mm-hmm.
And then we find, in terms of the environment, you know, the vaccine theory was discredited really quite a long time ago. But there are a number of factors, right, that come to play in autism risk. Mm-hmm. So I'll give you an example of some. So prematurity, right? More and more babies who are born premature or having had kind of what they call perinatal complications, which is, you know, something adverse that happens, you know, in utero or mm-hmm. around the time of birth. Those can increase autism risk. If you're premature, that's a pretty clear risk factor. Mm-hmm. And so more and more of those babies are surviving. And it's been estimated that up to 15% of autism cases are related to these kind of adverse perinatal events. Another one, you know, for example, there are a couple of drugs. There are these things called anticonvulsant drugs. Some of those are known to be related to autism risk. And then there are other drugs that seem to have some kind of effect, but we're not really sure. And that would be very, very early or preconceptional exposure to antidepressant drugs. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that is far from being confirmed, and it seems to be a pretty small effect.
This is could be like the mother taking an antidepressant drug.
Yes, it'd be like the mother taking antidepressant. But again, these are not big effects, and they seem to be only related to very, very early, kind of probably even preconception exposure, and it's really not confirmed. And you know, there's some evidence that some forms of artificial reproduction or assisted reproduction technology. IVF, but there are certain forms of IVF IVF, in vitro fertilization.
Okay.
Yeah. So, like, you know, I'm just kind of drawing a big picture. Like, if you were to make a pie chart, you can kind of divvy up, you know, maybe 20% for genetics and then maybe about another 20% for environment. But that leaves, you know, most of the pie, you know, kind of unaccounted for, right? Like, why do I have two autistic kids? And why do you have an autistic brother? Why does Kirk have an autistic son? Why? And in most cases, it's called idiopathic, meaning, you know, we really just don't know. You know, it seems to be genetic, but we can't really find it most of the time. So that kind of brings up a lot of interesting questions, because the autism rates have been increasing really dramatically. And I know there's like all this back and forth in the media of like, oh, is it just better ascertainment? Oh, is it diagnostic shift? Oh, is this stuff that we used to call like, you know, mental retardation or intellectual disability? Are we now calling it autism? And I think there is a little bit of that going on, but if you really look hard at the data and the evidence and really the overwhelming amount of epidemiology, it really shows there has been a very sharp increase in actual cases of this mysterious, you know, disability of autism. And California probably has the best data anywhere in the country. And that's for a lot of reasons, but what we see in the California data is about 3,000 cases of autism about 25 years ago, and today we have 83,000.
Right.
And it's not like this system, the California system, has expanded its criteria. It has not. California system
in
has actually...
Years, right.
Yeah, right. It's actually
made it harder.
It's
not like the 1950s where they were just sending, you know, crazy people to institutions with some blanket, you know, retardation that they would put on, you know, this 20 years ago is not long ago.
No. So 25 years. Yeah. It wasn't long ago. This has been really the past two decades that we've seen this really, you know, almost exponential growth in autism. And, you know, even if you were to take into account all the people who were institutions under other names and other labels,
right,
it still would not even come close, right, to scratching the surface of this big mountain.
Hmm.
So, you know, and then it sort of raises a question like, okay, autism is heritable, you know, it's probably genetic, and how can we have more and more cases? Incidentally, just back to your heritability question, if you have one child with autism, your risk for having a second child with autism is about 20%. So it's a lot higher than the general risk, which is, you know, 1-ish%. That's debatable what the actual background risk is. Mm-hmm. So a very, very significant heritability in autism.
So wait a minute. You said that really quickly, but this is what we talked about last week, right? So if I have one autistic child,
chances are 20%.
Then 20% chance that my next child is autistic. Is that right?
Yeah, that's pretty much what the research is showing now. Mm-hmm. But okay. it also shows that there's a higher risk for other kind of associated conditions that aren't necessarily autism.
Right.
They call it the broader autism phenotype. I don't make up these terms, but, you know, and that means like, you know, ADHD, learning disabilities, you know, things like that have some aspects of autism to them. So that might be about a 30% chance, right? But for autism itself, about 20%.
Well, I know I definitely have ADHD. So that
yeah,
would,
see,
that would
there you have it. You got a sibling thing going on in your own family.
I'm not even sure who I'm talking to right now.
Yeah, see, I told you this is the unfunny podcast, so like nobody's going to like, when are the jokes about autism research going to come in?
Punch this up, Jill. Come on, do your best five about autism research genetics.
Yeah, genetics. So funny.
Would you consider the hormones that your mother was given, the hormones that were administered to a lot of mothers in the 50s, 60s, and into the 70s, mm-hmm. would you mm-hmm. consider that sort of a prenatal problem, just like the ones you were describing before that would cause autism?
Yeah, so what's different? Okay, so I'll give a little background because people listening to this will be like, what? Prenatal hormones? What? What does that have to do with autism?
Right.
So my story is a little bit weird, and the science that I do is also a little bit novel. Genetics, when we're talking about genetics, what we're really talking about is like the molecular stuff in the sperm and egg, right? Mm-hmm. And that's your DNA, but it's also a lot more than your DNA because there's a lot of other, chemical on and off switches. There's sort of these little chemical instruction books that accompany the DNA that help inform, the developmental outcome of the offspring. And that's something called epigenetics. So everybody, here's your science term for the day. Epigenetics, E-P-I genetics. It basically means all that stuff on your DNA and around your DNA that tells the DNA what to do. So, when the sperm and the egg are developed and when they meet, it's not just the DNA that goes into action to create the little baby. It's also all of these chemical informants. So, let me kind of stop with that lecture there and then go into my own story.
Yeah, I was going to ask you. It is very interesting.
It's really, it's a really strange story. But I'm this mother of two children with, nonverbal autism, and I had absolutely no risk factors.
Mm-hmm.
I'm kind of, healthy, normal conceptions. I won't get into the details. normal birth, normal gestations, normal everything.
This is a PG podcast. Keep it clean. Keep
it clean,
this is
a PG podcast.
Now, more about the inception, please. Okay.
Continue.
Sorry.
I grew up in LA, not far from where Kirk and I, went to lunch recently in Beverly Hills. And, my husband also, no risk factors that anyone can think of. So it's kind of strange that this condition that used to be incredibly rare, I mean, when I grew up, I didn't know anybody with anything, like what my kids have, it would kind of come out from nowhere. And, I would talk to, I'm very well connected in the research world. I would talk to a lot of people about it. Nobody had any idea really what could have caused these really profound, disabilities in my children, and nothing showed up in the genetic scans that we did at the time. And also, they're very beautiful. They look perfectly normal. They don't have any syndromes that anyone can detect. So, what happened, right? And I kind of had no idea whatsoever what could have led to this highly abnormal outcome. And then 5 years ago, when I was 45, there's my age, something really weird happened, and that's that I happened to obtain records of medications that my mother was given when she was pregnant with me in 1965.
Oh, wow. And were you doing research? Were you trying to figure out the answer by, or you just randomly came across the?
It wasn't totally random. It's it was a funny thing. I was listening to a podcast about nutrition, and the podcaster was saying that, what a grandmother eats affects her grandchildren, or when the grandmother's pregnant. What a woman eats affects her grandchildren because the eggs, or the sperm, in that developing fetus are being formed in utero. A girl, learned this in high school biology, a girl is born with all her eggs. Mm-hmm. And then it occurred to me that maybe I had been exposed to something that had affected my eggs. Because if my eggs were tampered with, that means, the genetics, right, of my children would be tampered with, and maybe it would have this abnormal outcome. So I asked my mom, I'm like, hey, mom, I'm just wondering, did you take anything weird when you were pregnant with me? Like, you know, like, and I had a hunch, maybe a fertility treatment. And it's a long story why I had that hunch. And she said, yes. And she had gone to this specialty fertility clinic in West LA, right there in Westwood. And this guy was like the leading practitioner in the country for, you know, advanced fertility techniques. And he had given her, you know, a whole bunch of drugs while she was pregnant with me. And then I won't get it. This story is so long. I'm not going to get into how I actually got the records, but I actually got the physical records.
Good for you.
Showing what drugs I'd been exposed to. And that is like so rare. Like nobody has access to stuff like that. But I got pages and pages of detailed records. And so what were these drugs? Well, you know, I was conceived of in the mid-1960s, and it was really fashionable in the late 50s and the 60s to kind of administer to pregnant women who were thought to be at risk of miscarriage or at risk for other pregnancy complications. It was very fashionable to administer them high doses of what are called synthetic hormone drugs. And there were there were probably 20 of these drugs that were used. I was exposed to 5 of these drugs. These are fake, you know, fake progesterones, fake estrogens. The thought was if you enhanced, you know, the number, you know, the amount of these hormones in the pregnant woman's body, it would help retain the pregnancy. I mean, none of that was true. It was all, you know, it was all a medical myth.
Can I ask you a quick question?
It didn't, yeah.
Wouldn't that affect that
me?
Generation as well? So why wouldn't
yeah,
there be
wouldn't
a spike in autism
me?
In your generation?
No, it did not seem to increase autism in my generation. A lot of these drugs had very, very powerful adverse effects. Some of them caused cancer. Some of them caused infertility. They caused
sometimes
other things that aren't so PG rated, but they cause, you know, urogenital abnormalities. They caused all kinds of problems. There, I don't know of any evidence that they caused autism, you know, in my generation.
So, to bring it all back for our listener, you had two autistic children. You're trying to figure out what the heck. I have nothing, no causalities in my history on either side. What and you were listening to this podcast about eating correctly and everything, and then it could affect two generations later. And so you came across your mother's medical records, and she was pumped with hormones, and you're like, there it is. And so you funded, after that point, I'm probably skipping ahead a bunch of steps, you started funding medical research to see if this was the actual cause.
Right. Okay. So, you know, I had this idea that maybe, you know, these exposures, these drugs that, you know, that I was exposed to when I was a fetus, that maybe they affected my eggs, et cetera, as you just said. And so what happened after that is I did two things. I started calling up other autism families and saying, hey, you know, I just found out this weird thing about me. Do you happen to know if you have a similar story? And slowly but surely, I started compiling stories of families that had very, very similar exposures. And, you know, with autistic kids, I thought, okay, well, that's really interesting. You know, I have, it's not just me, you know, there are other case studies. And some of them are really interesting. A lot of them, these people have multiple children with autism, just like I do, which I think should be the biggest red flag. And then the other thing I did was I just started calling researchers really around the world who work in this field, which is called epigenetics, or sometimes it's, you know, in the field of reproductive biology, where they're really looking at gametes and the molecular aspects of gametes and how they respond to environmental toxicants. And oh my God, I can't even tell you how many researchers. I think I exhausted the whole polls of certain universities.
We should let our listeners know that you're a lawyer. And
I was,
You were a lawyer, and so it probably really helps to have a sort of diligence and research.
I was
skills.
A little bit persistent.
Yeah.
And, you know, and what happened was, out of all those conversations with dozens and dozens of researchers, is, you know, I put together some preliminary, what I call pilot research projects to start looking at these ideas that not only, you know, the weirdo drugs that I was exposed to, but things that were more common, like maternal smoking, which is a known mutagen, right? We know that causes mutations. You know, why aren't we looking at this stuff? You know, nobody had really asked the question before. And so that's really where I am now. I'm in the process of, I continually fund pilot projects and conferences and meetings to try to draw attention to this idea that this, these genetic artifacts that we're seeing in autism, you know, may actually be related to certain exposures. They may not be random, at least in all cases. I'm sure some of them are certainly random. But, you know, in some cases, they might not be random. And if they're not random, well, you know, that's important. That's something, so, you know, that, that people should know.
Let me jump in and ask, what, so, like, what's next? These, you talk about these being pilot programs. So the idea is it draws attention to it, and then perhaps Stanford or somebody funds a larger study, or...
That's exactly right. You know, for non-scientists, you guys are pretty smart. That's exactly right. So, like, if these are small little projects, and if, you know, the little projects can have a little signal saying, hey, it looks like there's, you know, a higher rate of, you know, XYZ related to whatever exposure. You know, if I could do those little pilot projects, and that will attract attention from the larger funders, like the National Institutes of Health. Believe me, you know, the big funders aren't, you know, like the government funders. They aren't the ones who are going to take the risk, right, out the door with, like, you know, wacky new ideas. It has to be kind of more grassroots. So, you know, that's what I've been doing. And I partner with other entities. I partner with Autism Speaks. I partner with Autism Science Foundation in trying to bring to light some of these emerging concepts that, you know, could affect the future of autism research.
Where can our listeners...
Yeah, that's what I do in a little tiny nutshell. And I should say, I actually have a website if people want to...
Great, that's what I was going to ask.
Learn
where
more.
Can our listeners
very
find
easy.
This information?
Oh, it's just my name. It's Jill Escher, ESCHER.com.
Great. And what scientifically has this been corroborated at all? Have you know?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So, you know, I just have these pilot projects off the ground, and one thing I can say about science is it's excruciatingly slow. So I don't. People are like, "Where's your data? Where's your results?" I'm like, you know, who knows? Like, it just takes a long time to do any of the work, and the projects I do are very small because I'm not Bill Gates and I can't fund, you know, massive projects looking at hundreds of cases. I just can't do that. So I'll try to win the lottery, but, you know, that's kind of a long shot. So, you know, here's what's going on. You know, getting really direct evidence of these generational effects is very hard because it's very hard to get the old exposure data. And sometimes when you have the old exposure data, you don't have the autism data, right? You need kind of both sets.
Right.
And then there's a whole bunch of intervening factors that could affect, you know, the outcome, in, you know, the, you know, any kind of autism-related outcome. So, you know, there's a lot of complexity in this kind of research. It's very seldom done because of the level of complexity. That said, you know, there's direct evidence, just like in the legal system, and there's circumstantial evidence. The circumstantial evidence is when you can connect a lot of dots, right, to come to a result, but you might not have a straight line to that result. You might not have an eyewitness. And, you know, some of the stronger circumstantial evidence relates to the fact that what we're finding in these autism mutations is that they're very, even between siblings with autism, like my own two kids, you know, that they're very what's called heterogeneous. They're not the same mutations. We're seeing a lot of what looks like kind of random stuff, right, happening throughout the genome. And they're not inherited from the mother or father. Seldom are these mutations actually inherited. They happen what's called de novo. They happen in the sperm or egg that give rise to the autistic child. So they're brand new, right? And, you know, there's evidence like that that's saying, this is kind of fishy. This is a very unusual pattern that you don't generally see inheritable disease, so, or disorders. So, you know, could there be some intervening factor here? And then there's an emerging science directly looking at what I called epigenetics, looking at these epigenetic molecular artifacts in autism. And that's really a brand new emerging field, but a very hot one. So, you know, it's again, and then also, you know, you look at the timing of the autism epidemic, and it really is an epidemic. Some people don't like that word, but I don't know what else to call it. I mean, when you go from 3,000 to 83,000, I don't know what else you call it.
Is it rising still? Do we know that?
It's still rising. In fact, in California, we're adding about 5,000 new autism cases a year, and that's only in the developmental services system. If you were to include the education system and the clinical system, it could be easily double that. Mm-hmm. It's a huge number. It has not shown any sign of slowing down, which is really concerning because this is a, you know, as we know, our system of supporting, mm-hmm. you know, especially adults with autism, is already pushed to the maximum. You know, there's not much room for growth at all. And it's very scary to think, you know, how will we, you know, care for all these adults? And that's a whole other podcast. This is something we work on at Autism Society.
Absolutely. It's something we discuss with our immediate family members on this podcast. Mm-hmm. Jill, this has been really, really informative.
One quick...
Yeah, it's funny. Sorry.
No.
Well, Jill, I wanted to give you... We're running out of time, but I wanted to change the subject quickly and ask you about the book Neurotribes, because I know you heard us talk about it, and then you sent me an immediate email. So you've got 1 minute to give us a quick...
You had mentioned on the podcast that Jill from San Francisco, she loved that book.
I got mixed up on that one, yeah. So give us...
I did not love that book. Okay, I get 1 minute. Oh, you know, listen.
Take a couple. We want you to flush it out.
You know, there's a great thing about Neurotribes, which is it's a very loving, caring approach to people with autism, if people have read the book. Mm-hmm. I mean, clearly the author has a big heart for people with autism and really cares about their future. And he sees them not as, you know, disabled people worthy of our pity. He sees them as full and valuable members of our community. And
but...
I completely embrace that, like 100%, like, you know, although I fully admit my kids are very, very disabled, I am a big fan of a very positive view of people with these, you know, neurodevelopmental differences. So, I mean, there's definitely parts about that book which are good. He's hardly original in taking that approach, but it's a good one and an important one. You know, where I differ with him is, you know, he takes and I don't want to get in too much in the details. You know, the whole theme of the book is that, you know, all this autism has always been here and we really haven't noticed it. And we just labeled it other stuff. And, you know, and we're not really experiencing a surge in numbers. We're experiencing what he called an optical illusion, you know, based on changing diagnostic criteria. And that's just not true. And it's a really damaging myth, you know, that is perpetuated based on incredibly flimsy evidence. It's a very ideological approach. I mean, yeah, there's some of that kind of switcheroo going on, diagnostic switcheroo.
Which we talked about on the top end of this interview. There, you know, it doesn't amount to the... It only accounts for a small percentage.
And you know, as I said, I'm a complete geek. I talk with autism researchers all the time. And pretty much nobody agrees with Silberman with his conclusions.
Just the simple fact that in the past 20 years, we've had a surge from 5,000 to 85,000, and it's only been 20 years. This isn't the 1950s where we're sticking everybody with any sort of abnormality in a giant institution. We had some research, so that...
Yeah.
In California, anyway, with 80 to...
Yeah, and, you know, you can control for all kinds of other artifacts like that, like who's in the institution. You still can't explain this enormous surge, and that really is the consensus now, is that it's there. We still don't know what's causing it, and I don't pretend to know what's causing everything. I pretend to think I know a portion of it. But, you know, I think, you know, he kind of comes to this conclusion in the book that, you know, we've done our research, we've been there, done that, you know, it's all over, let's not research, you know, causes of autism. Whereas, from my point of view, we're barely scratching the surface.
Right.
We're only just starting to embark on this incredible journey of figuring out what is going on. So I look at it very different, you know, than he does. But that's a longer than 1 minute answer. Well,
no, we needed to hear that. I think our listeners needed to, maybe if they don't even agree, it's nice to hear a different perspective. And my father just read that book, and he found it informative, and I'm sure he's going to find the last 2 minutes very, very interesting and informative. So we appreciate that.
I appreciate that, Jill. I know we talked about this quickly, and I wanted to get your point of view. It's important to have. I know there's differing points of view on about the subject, and I'm so excited to have you on the podcast.
You were great. Thank you.
Great job.
Wow. Thanks for, you know, doing some science. And Kurt, we look forward to seeing you. I'm going to plug your show February 20th in Palo Alto.
February 20th. Yes, I'm excited. It's going to be great. It's going to be great.
It will be great. I can't wait.
Jill Asher, everybody, go to her website, JILLESCHER.com, everybody.
Graham's the name expert on this podcast.
Thank you for spelling, Graham. Thank you.
All right. Thanks again. Take care.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. See you soon.
That was very, very informative. Very like jam-packed. I like that interview a lot. That was jam-packed with info.
My brain is full. I got to be honest. That was a lot of information. I was scribbling notes, and that was a lot.
Yeah,
that was a lot of information.
Just a bunch of pictures of. But at the end, there's a picture of a cake, a car.
I drew a lightning bolt.
Yeah, lightning bolt.
There's a lot going on.
Yeah, I learned. I love that interview. I learned a lot. She's very nice, very smart, and the autism community needs more people like Jill, because we don't know what causes it yet. Regardless of if your neurotribes is correct or not, we do not know what causes autism, and we need people who are looking. And she's got a hot lead on something that could really be an actual cause. And it's really impressive, the story. She basically figured this out herself, and then got researchers who are on their way to corroborating this evidence, hopefully. So, and she's got a lot of circumstantial evidence, you know.
I think it's great that...
I don't even know if I use circumstantial correct. She's a lawyer. She might write us back and be like...
I'll edit that part. But I think it's great that we all fit a different part.
Mm-hmm.
I think that some people are encouraged by the podcast. Other people do research. Other people tell jokes about it.
No, that was great. Guys, thank you very much for being a part of it and listening. We really appreciate it. Well, thank you to all of us who listen to us on iTunes and other forms. Such as SoundCloud. Also, like us if you haven't. Share us if you haven't. Tell your friends. Give us a good rating. And find us on Facebook. I am at Graham K. Comedy. GRAHAMKAY Comedy on Twitter. And Kirk?
Kirk Smith Comedy.
Kirk Smith Comedy. Yeah, and email us at Autastic Podcast. @gmail.com.
Thanks for listening, guys.
Thanks very much. Bye-bye.